Okay, well, I think it's 7:05, so I'm going to start. So, today's topic is the Church, Eastern Europe and the Ottomans, which obviously would be a huge topic and is really several topics to cover in one lecture, so I'm not actually going to. I'm going to highlight some sort of themes and some of the general information. Then I'm going to look at some more, I suppose, microcosmic examples. If you want a more detailed general survey, you've got a reading list. So, yeah, because there just isn't time to kind of do a lesson. So I suppose the main thing to get our heads around is the geography of Eastern Europe, and in particular the Ottoman Empire. I mean, more or less, the Ottoman Empire is expanding during the 16th and 17th century, and from the late 17th century it starts to contract. The territories that it acquires obviously include direct conquest and those which become sort of semi-attached vassal states where the rulers acknowledge some sort of overlordship of the Ottoman Sultan. And of course the religious makeup of these different states is very different and the situation is very different depending on the degree of Ottoman control. Now since the Ottoman Empire is avowedly an Islamic empire, you can see why this Ottoman expansion worries Catholic and indeed Christian powers on a cultural, religious level as well as a political level. Look how close the Ottoman Empire gets to Vienna, which is the heart of the Habsburg Empire. The Ottomans are political and military rivals to the Habsburgs, to the Venetians, and so on. They are also a religious and cultural threat. You can also see it might worry ordinary people if you're going about your business in Italy, whether it's in the north, right up near Venice, watching the Balkans almost down to the Adriatic coast fall to the Ottomans, or whether you're down in Otranto, where famously a raid in the late 15th century resulted in the killing of, I think it was over 1,000 citizens of Otranto who were taken prisoner. You can see why this was a worry. And of course, you know, historians can debate endlessly what were the advantages and disadvantages of actually living under Ottoman rule, and what was the degree of religious freedom that people had, and what was the, basically, how much did ordinary people mind being transferred from Christian to Islamic rule. But, you know, on balance, for preference, most ordinary people in Europe probably didn't want their local cathedral to be turned into a mosque. The second map is a bit later. Sorry, it's a little harder to read. And that's showing more the contraction of the Ottoman Empire from the late 17th century. Partly, of course, partly at the hands of the Habsburgs, who start this kind of pushback and reclaim, for example, the whole of the Kingdom of Hungary and Transylvania, go back from Ottoman control. And also Greece, importantly, gains its independence. That's much later in the 19th century. So you do have a gradual contraction from the late 17th century, and this is in large part due to counter-offensives from the Western European powers. Now, just to kind of put it some detail on that,
The Battle of Lepanto in 1571 becomes a famous, almost iconic event in Western Europe. There's a temptation to see it as somehow epitomising Ottoman and Western relations. We have this alliance calling itself a Holy League, very much engineered by the papacy. They really needed this to happen. They got together to counter the Ottoman expansion in the Mediterranean, and you know, when they win this sea battle of Lepanto, it's somewhat against the odds. It was a bit of a the Sultan had put out this huge fleet, and somehow or other the coalition fleet manages to defeat it. And it was very much placed in a religious context. Pius V had organised this massive prayer campaign, and he had exhorted Catholics all over Europe to pray for victory. And so when the Holy League fleet did win the victory, this was seen as sort of saving Christendom from the Turk. Now, of course, the Holy League didn't, in fact, last. It didn't turn into a grand coalition, which is always what the papacy wants. They're separate states involved. They all eventually made peace in that particular war with the Ottomans separately. They went back to fighting amongst each other. The religious nature of the whole fight can be exaggerated. Like, everyone, all the soldiers in this fight are not seeing themselves as religious, as sort of religious crusaders. For example, there were reports after the battle of Christian prisoners who'd been rowing Ottoman galleys being killed indiscriminately along with their Ottoman captors when the galleys were captured by the Holy League forces, because the soldiers are mainly interested in victory and they're not kind of holding, hold the sword in the air and go, excuse me, hang on a minute, are you a Christian? You can exaggerate the sense in which this is a religious battle in a religious war. Both a kind of result and a cause of the conflict and the war in the Mediterranean was the slave trade, which went both ways, as it were. Slaving networks, as a fact of Mediterranean history for a very long time. Sometimes, quite often, slavery between these warring powers is almost more like a prisoners of war ransoming and exchange system. People were taken and then they were held until they were either exchanged for other prisoners or ransomed, either by their relatives or, for example, in Italy and Spain, there were religious orders founded which were dedicated to ransoming people who had been captured and sold by the Ottomans. But this wasn't always the case. I mean, sometimes it's clear that people are just being bought and sold as slave labour and they're not being held as prisoners for ransom, although they may, in course of time, be ransomed. And the slave trade was largely driven by the need for galley oarsmen, because all the powers in the Mediterranean used fleets made of galleys rowed by oarsmen. They needed oarsmen. They couldn't get enough by using either convict labour or paid volunteers. So slaves became essential to the functioning of the fleet. But as I said, it also included chattel slavery. Corsairing, which are basically state-licensed pirates, also went both ways. The capturing of enemy shipping, where you can then take the ship, take the goods, and probably enslave and sell the people that you've captured. Both sides had this idea that you can only enslave unbelievers, you can't enslave believers, which meant that they almost, as it were, needed each other in order to keep up their supply of galley slaves. There seem to have been similar numbers of Europeans and North African or Ottoman subjects actually enslaved in this trade. So it was definitely not predominantly Europeans taking North Africa and Middle Eastern people, nor was it exclusively Barbary traders taking people from Western Europe. Now, basically, if you're looking at the Ottoman and Western European conflict, there are two errors you can fall into. One is to assume that the religious conflict dictates everything, and to assume a paradigm of constant ideologically motivated hostility between an Islamic power and Christian powers, and ignoring the realities of trade, diplomacy, and obviously the non-ideological components of conflict. The second error you can make is to ignore the embedded ideological hostility completely, and to, as it were, explain it away. The religious and cultural oppositions were real. In studying Eastern Europe, the Ottomans and Catholicism, you inevitably meet the Orthodox churches. So just to kind of run through what basically are the Orthodox churches in relation to Rome. Now, way back in the during the 4th to 5th centuries, the Roman Empire essentially moved its main centre from Rome to Constantinople, which is now called Istanbul. It was also, during its Roman days, known as Byzantium. Constantinople became the preeminent centre of Christianity in the East, with the Patriarch of Constantinople, which is basically, a patriarch is similar to an archbishop in the Western Church. Meanwhile, the Western Church was much more closely connected to Rome, and in terms of the religious culture, spirituality, the liturgy, and eventually even theology, the sort of two halves of Christendom start to drift apart. Probably not helped by the Arab/Muslim expansion from the 7th century onwards, which reduced communication between the two, because you had this kind of swathe of, if not hostile, at least potentially hostile territory in between. The main patriarchates, so by 1054, you have a formal schism. The Catholic Church is centred in Rome. The Orthodox Church is not a single institution, although they have a kind of connection between each other even today. And its main patriarchates are in Moscow in Russia and Constantinople. Now, the key thing is that Orthodox churches and the Catholic Church are institutionally separate, but their doctrines are very, very similar. They believe almost identical things, and also they recognise each other's sacraments as being valid. So Catholics recognise that if an Orthodox priest says the Mass and consecrates the bread and wine, then it really is like the body and blood of Jesus. It's a valid Mass. And equally, the Orthodox would recognise the same thing about Catholic Masses. They still regard each other as wrong, but they recognise the validity of each other's sacraments, which is not the case with Protestants. Catholics don't believe. Catholics think that, you know, if at a Protestant Eucharistic service, there's nothing happens to the bread and wine. It doesn't become the body and blood, because it's not a real valid Mass. There have been various official attempts to kind of reunite the churches. In 1439, at the Council of Florence, a reunion was actually agreed, but then it was swiftly repudiated by the Orthodox patriarchs. But in any case, only 14 years after the Council of Florence, there was the fall of Constantinople. The Ottoman Empire has been conquering the Byzantine Empire piecemeal for a long time, and the fall of Constantinople was basically the final thing, the final end of that empire. He changes its name to Istanbul. What you see there, Hagia Sophia, was of course the preeminent church of Constantinople, and it was changed at that point into a Muslim mosque. The Orthodox Church continues to exist, but it kind of exists basically on the Sultan's terms. He got to control, the Sultan got to control, you know, the appointment of the patriarch, and he got to, and he could charge taxes and payments from the Orthodox Church via the patriarch. And importantly, the Orthodox Patriarch and all of his subordinate bishops had to operate almost as Ottoman officials. They had to have a writ from the Sultan to allow them to operate. There was a limited toleration for Christians. They were not forbidden to exist, but there was not what you would call religious freedom. Christians under Ottoman rule, they're not allowed to publicly express their religion, that they're not allowed to say anything in public that officially disagrees with Islamic theology, they're not allowed to preach their religion, and no one is allowed to convert from Islam to Christianity. That includes, of course, Christians who might have become Muslim for material gain or for some other reason, and who might then want to revert to their former faith, and that is not, they're not allowed to do. And most of the couple of hundred martyrs from the Ottoman period who Orthodox Christians commemorate today, a lot of them were Christians who had converted to Islam and who wanted to revert, and that was the reason for their execution. So what does this mean for Catholics? Well, how they view the Orthodox kind of depends sort of who you're comparing it with. In one way they viewed it was that, in a sense, the Ottoman conquest is a kind of fitting sequel to rejecting Christ's vicar, as one English Catholic put it. Sure it is that for the withdrawal of their obedience from the succession of Peter, the Grecians are compelled to obey the succession of Muhammad. So, in a sense, the Turks, as they call them, are a bad thing, but they're sort of, like, in a sense, a fitting penalty because the Orthodox Church had rejected the Vicar of Christ. Now, it's also worth noting that Protestants also saw the Turks partly through the lens of their relations with Catholicism. They, in the early Protestant reformers, saw the Turks as potentially kind of friends of the gospel, as they put it, because basically the Turks are bad news for the papists. It's the kind of my enemy's enemy is my friend. And they appeared to kind of condone or even promote Protestantism, at least against the papists. However, by the mid-16th century, this kind of initial... optimism had rather gone off, and the Protestants realised that their enemy's enemy wasn't in fact entirely their friend in this case. But as well in the mix of the Catholic Church in the West and the Orthodox Churches, you also have to reckon with the Eastern Catholic Churches, which basically was when some Orthodox churches, or parts of them, institutionally reunited with the Catholic Church, which basically means they recognise the authority of the Pope. But they retain their own distinctive liturgy and many other devotional practices, and some quite important ones. For example, in Eastern Catholic churches, they do in fact ordain married men, as the Orthodox do, and unlike the Western Catholic Church. And these newly reunited churches, they often coexist in the same geographical area, not always peacefully, with their Orthodox counterparts. Some of the reunion arrangements that existed or were initiated in the early modern period are listed up here. Some of them were successful, some of them, their reunion was achieved, but then it fell apart again. And quite often that was because the Latin, as they're called, the Latin Western Christian Catholics were sort of trying to insist on Latinization of the religious culture rather than allowing the distinctive traditions to continue, and this is what sometimes called problems. So most of Western European Catholic Church is what we call the Latin Rite, whereas Eastern Catholic Church, when many of the other rites include Byzantine, Melkite, Syro-Malabar, and so on. The Jesuits were working on Catholic Orthodox reunion in the Ukraine from about 1569, and in 1595 there was a unity between Rome and Kiev was declared, which of course was promptly rejected by the Orthodox Church in Constantinople, but by about 1700, possibly two-thirds of the Ukraine was part of the Ukrainian Catholic Church. And a less successful attempt was in India with the Syro-Malabar Rite, where it wasn't until after the Schism of 1653, it was not until much later in the modern period that a Syro-Malabar Rite in union with Rome was re-established. Now, Catholic reform did include missions of some sort among most of the Ottoman territories. And obviously the religious situation was different in different territories. So, for example, in Hungary, it was actually divided in three parts after the Ottomans won the Battle of Mahash in 1526. There's Ottoman Hungary, which is directly ruled by the Ottomans. There's Habsburg Hungary, which was the bit that the Austrian Habsburgs actually hung on to as kings of Hungary. And then there was the Principality of Transylvania, which was an Ottoman vassal state that remained basically Christian. And of course, in these places, as well as there being Muslim rulers in some of them, and some ordinary Muslims, there were also Jews, and there were any number of different sorts of Christians. Orthodox, Protestant, anti-Trinitarian groups, Catholics, Eastern Catholics, Western Catholics. The Catholic Church had some sort of presence in most of these, including in Istanbul, where there were Jesuits and also Capuchins ministering basically to ambassadors, to merchants who were trading in Istanbul, and of course to Christian slaves. They couldn't convert Muslims, or even safely, they couldn't convert Christians who had become Muslim, but they ministered to existing Catholics, and they could also, and did, attempt to convert Orthodox Christians or other heretics. These missions always ran into conflict. There was conflict between Orthodox and Catholics. There was conflict between different Catholic religious orders. For example, the Bosnian Franciscans, who basically retained responsibility for Catholic missions and churches throughout the Balkans, and who did not take kindly to Jesuit missionaries coming in and competing with them in Hungary and Albania. Also, Catholic orders did not mind involving the Ottoman authorities in their conflicts against Orthodox or indeed Catholic opponents, and vice versa. In some ways, Ottoman restrictions on Christianity influenced this because, for example, you weren't allowed to build new church buildings. So who controls the churches really matters, because you can't build a new one. The different groups will be in conflict over who is going to get control of the church endorsed by the Ottoman rulers. It's also pointed out that although Rome sponsored missions in these various territories, what was spent on, for example, missions in the Balkans was a fraction of what the Papacy was spending trying to make war in order to putatively liberate the Balkans from Ottoman control altogether. So military spending was greater than mission spending, although from the papacy's point of view, of course, the end goal is the same, so they didn't see this as incompatible. So to move on to try and talk about some examples which may are more illustrative and which kind of might give you a key a sort of handle on what you're reading in general, in more general terms. Kirill Loukaris was the Patriarch of Constantinople. In the picture here, you can see he's wearing a monastic habit because he was actually a monk before he became the Patriarch. He's the Patriarch under the Ottomans. So he was a Patriarch on the Sultan's say-so, and he had to operate within the expectations of the Ottoman rulers. What's interesting about Loukaris is that he very much engaged with the Reformation processes that had happened in Western Europe, and he reopened contact with Protestants. Protestants had first been contacting Constantinople from the 1570s because it was basically, well, we both don't like the Catholics, so let's see maybe if we have something in common. But during the 1570s, there was some correspondence, and what became apparent was that they just had very different theology. The Orthodox agreed with the Protestants in rejecting the Pope, but they did not agree with them about sola fide or sola scriptura, or liturgical changes, or the rejection of most of the sacraments, or, for example, the rejection of images and devotion to images. So those sort of talks wound up by about 1590, with the Patriarch saying, look, it's fine, send me letters as friends, I'm happy to hear from you, but please stop talking theology, because, like, that's a dead end. But Loukaris kind of reopens contact with the Protestants, we know that in 1600, before he's Patriarch, he'd been on extensive missions to Poland and Lithuania, where the Orthodox Church was being to some degree oppressed by the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And he contacted Protestants there and to an extent made common cause with them, trying to achieve greater liberty within Poland and Lithuania. He was continually putting out writing polemic about against what he called Latin propaganda in Orthodox lands, to try and stop Roman Catholics sort of trespassing on his territory, as it were. His negotiations with the Church of England, which in a sense was the Protestant Church that had kind of the most in common institutionally and externally with Orthodox practices, including sending envoys to England and corresponding with the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud, who was notoriously the most kind of high church Anglican prelate around in the 17th century. So, I mean, this is partly an enemies at my enemy's enemy thing, but it was also that Loukaris seems to have a genuine dissatisfaction with some elements of orthodoxy. Some of what he saw as the extravagance of orthodox devotion, he criticised what he witnessed, for example, of orthodox pilgrims in the Holy Land and the way that they venerated relics, which he felt, you know, possibly did border on idolatry. So he was also attracted to the alleged evangelical simplicity of Protestantism. It wasn't just a convenient alliance. On the other hand, he was also keen on practices like canonising new saints and revitalising monasteries, and so elements of religious practice that were not in line with Protestantism at all. In 1627, interestingly, he sets up the first printing press in Istanbul, but a lot of what he prints there is anti-Catholic tracts because he feels beleaguered by the Catholics at this time. He receives some assistance from the British ambassador in setting up his press and in printing his anti-Catholic material, unsurprisingly. However, reportedly it was the Jesuits in league with the French ambassador who managed to incite a sack of the printing press by the Janissaries, who are, of course, the Sultan's elite guard. So, you know, cheers for that Christian solidarity there. This is the kind of thing that happens all the time. The Jesuits and Capuchins who were present in Istanbul apparently, you know, constantly worked against Kirill because basically they don't want him to unite with the Protestants. And Kirill Lukaris turns to support for the British and the Dutch. So there are all these political, national and religious groupings all working for and against each other. There was also inevitably an opposing faction within the Orthodox Synod, the governing body of the Orthodox Church, which also was working against Lukaris. Now, it seems quite possible that his allies, his Dutch and British allies, kind of caused problems for Lukaris and pressured him to go in a more Protestant direction than he was really happy with. And this may have been what led to the basically a Protestant Confession of Christian Faith, signed by Lukaris in 1629, eagerly published in Swiss and French by the Protestants back in Western Europe, and finally published in Greek in 1633. And it became rather infamous among the Orthodox because of how Protestant it was and how out of line it was with traditional Orthodox theology. Now, Lukaris, interestingly, never explicitly admitted that he had written the confession, but he also never formally disowned it or condemned it. And the debate on the authorship, the actual authorship of the confession, continues to this day. So, in 1638, Kirill was finally arrested by the Ottomans, and he was charged with treasonous communications with the Russians, and he was then executed. Now, and it was reported that his enemies, including his Christian enemies, including the Jesuits and the papacy, had actually engineered this to get rid of him. Subsequent synods of the Orthodox Church condemned the Lukaris Confession of Faith, although they avoided condemning Lukaris as the author. But of course, the kind of reaction against Lukaris is potential Protestant reforms caused was a kind of anti-Protestant spirit in Orthodoxy, which contributed to a later 17th, rather temporary, rapprochements between the Catholic and the Orthodox in the later 17th century. So while Kirill Lukaris' reforms didn't really send the Orthodox Church in a Protestant direction permanently, this is an interesting example of how in Eastern Europe, there are these kind of mutual negotiations between Orthodox, Protestant, Catholics, in which the Ottoman state is also a player, and in which different Christian factions are quite willing to ally with the Ottoman state when they need to, and It's an example of the spread, both the spread in a way and the limits of the Reformation. Turning to another figure in Poland. Right. Poland, Lithuania at this time was the largest state in Western Europe, geographically. It was huge. This is because the Lithuanian, the union between Poland, the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania had been established in 1569. And of course, it's ethnically and religiously a very broad range too. I'm sorry, the map is not that easy to read, but if you look at the key, you can see that there are vast tracts of Lutheran lands, as well as Catholics, Orthodox, and so on. And they are very much mixed in the Poland-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Calvinism made some headway in the mid-16th century, but its support was always much higher among the nobility than among the general population. Poland-Lithuania is a reminder that religious toleration is not some kind of linear progression, where, you know, we kind of assume that the closer you get to us, the more toleration there is, and the further you go back, the less toleration there is. In Poland, Lithuania, 1573, religious toleration was legally established. But then there was a lot of hostility from the crown and so on towards Protestant denominations, chipping away at their influence, their legal status and so on. And in 1668, again, they don't make it a crime outright to practice Protestantism, but they make it a crime to convert away from Catholicism, which is obviously quite a serious deterrent for any growth of Protestantism. Notably, Poland is a kingdom, but Poland at this time had an elective monarchy. The king was elected, and it wasn't a formality. They didn't just repeatedly elect father and son, father and son. The succession in Poland is actually quite an interesting thing, and there are several times when it's very much in doubt, and you get, you know, rival contenders and different powers kind of playing into trying to get their man elected. Now, this doesn't mean this was some kind of democratic system, because he was elected only by the szlachta, the nobility, who comprised about 2% of the population. It's, of course, among the nobility that Protestantism is strongest, and yet the nobility are unable to resist the determination of a couple of strong monarchs to promote Catholicism. And it wasn't only, though, coercion. The missions of the Jesuits were very important. They revitalised Catholicism, they preach, they teach, and crucially they run schools. And their running of schools was particularly influential, because they ran actually quite good schools academically, and quite a lot of Protestants also used to use them. And inevitably over time, this kind of consolidates Catholicism and decreases adherence to Protestantism. Jakub Wujek is one of these Jesuits, and he is interesting because he was responsible for the first printed Polish Catholic Bible. It was not the first Polish Bible. There had been a couple of attempts at translation before, and there had already been, of course, a Protestant Polish Bible. What's first interesting about Wujek is the recognition that there needs to be Catholic vernacular Bibles as well, that it's necessary for countering Protestantism and the Protestant claim that our faith is more biblical than yours, basically, to translate, to present Catholic editions from the Bible, which Catholics are permitted to read, and crucially, because most editions of the Bible at this time included what you call a gloss, which is basically where the editors tell you, they print the Bible and then they kind of tell you how you should be interpreting it. And one thing that Catholics object to with translations of scripture is they say, yes, but first of all, you're translating it wrong. That's always a debate, whose translation is really the more accurate. You're translating it wrong so that it appears to endorse Protestant beliefs, but actually, you know, if you translate it, you know, your choice of words is influencing what the Bible appears to mean here. And secondly, they object to the glosses, because they say they put all these marginalia in which kind of direct the reader to interpret the Bible in a Protestant way. So that's why they want a Catholic edition, because then, first of all, Protestants can't say that Catholics never read the Bible, because here is one. And you can direct Catholic readers to read the Bible, and you can direct them towards a Catholic interpretation, so that when Protestants claim that their faith is more biblical, your Catholic students and educated Catholic people are able to say, no, that's not the right interpretation, because I read that really you should interpret this verse in that way. So it's a recognition that they need to do this in order to keep up their end, as it were, against the spread of Protestantism. It also, of course, recognises that, like, although it became an issue in many places, there was not a monolithic Catholic ban on vernacular scripture. Vernacular scripture had been much more acceptable in different some geographical areas than in others, and in some cultures than others within Western European Catholicism. So it's not a monolithic ban on reading the scripture. It's more that Catholic authorities are very, very cautious about allowing it, and they're very clear that there are certain, that there are dangers about it, and that there are certain good reasons for translating scripture, and if those good reasons don't exist, then you don't do it. What the other thing that's very interesting about the Wyatt's Bible is, as has been argued by one scholar, David Frick, is that it was heavily influenced by the English Catholic Bible that had been published, its New Testament had been published in 1582. And Wyatt explicitly acknowledges the Douay-Rheims Testament as one of his models and sources. But Frick has argued that it's not just that, it's the dominant source. So we have this Jesuit working in Poland who apparently is using as his model the Bible translations and the Bible commentaries produced by English Catholics for an English Catholic, a Catholic audience in Protestant England. And I suppose that's just an interesting example of the cross-cultural influence going all the way across Europe, and the way that Catholic networks, only partly Jesuit networks, but Catholic reformist networks could reach across Europe in this way. There was not a lot of mutual knowledge of English language and Polish language at this time, but we do know that Wyatt, for example, would have been in contact with Stanislaw Hozius, who was the sort of premier reforming Catholic prelate in Poland, and Hozius was a friend of William Allen, who was the de facto leader of English Catholics in exile. And in consequence of his sort of friendship with Allen, Hozius fostered a lot of Scottish and English Catholic exiles in Poland. And therefore, it could have been through this medium that Wyatt could have known English and Scottish Catholics, therefore could have known about the Douay-Rheims, and perhaps may have had assistance from one of them in reading and using the English language commentary. And a third, figure who's revealing of Catholic and Catholic Eastern relations is Adetshin IV. And what's in this picture, we have here a picture in the Sala Regia of the Vatican Palace, which is painted in the 1580s, so at the height of Rome's kind of Catholic Reformation pomp. It doesn't depict an event of the 1580s, it depicts an event from about 200 years before, called the Peace of Venice, which is where basically the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick had been at loggerheads for some time, and the Doge, the ruler of Venice, who's here in the distinctive hat just next to the Pope, has engineered a peace between them in which Frederick acknowledges the Pope's religious authority by paying homage. He's kneeling before the papal throne, and he's actually kissing the Pope's foot to acknowledge primacy of the successor of Peter. But in this kind of image of basically the triumph, a triumph of the papacy, among all these dignitaries standing around watching reconciliation, there's this chap here in a turban. Now, he wasn't there, obviously, at the original event, but for some reason, and it's been identified that this is effectively a portrait of Abdisho IV, this Eastern Catholic patriarch from Mosul in modern Iraq, who had travelled to Rome in the 1560s. And he's placed in this historical setting because he, in a sense, like this celebration of the Pope reasserting his authority over the church and also over the Holy Roman Emperor, he in a sense represents the authority of the papacy to unify the church and to be this supreme governing figure over the Christian churches. And I think that's why he's been painted into this historic scene. So Abdusha's story is that Mosul, modern Iraq, the dominant church there was the Eastern Syriac Church, and a large section of this church had become dissatisfied because their patriarchate had become a hereditary office, and it was being passed down just through this one family who were, they would sometimes, for example, appoint a minor, a child, as the patriarch. And this faction grew dissatisfied with this way of doing things and with the control of this family over the church, and so they elect a rival patriarch, one Yohanan Sulakar. Sulakar travelled to Rome in 1553. He made a Catholic profession of faith and was confirmed as patriarch by Rome, thus acknowledging Roman authority and effectively reuniting the church he represented with Rome. Now, of course, the Orthodox patriarchy didn't like this, and they kind of connived with the Ottoman rulers to get Sulakar imprisoned and then executed on his return. But he has a successor as what they now call the Chaldean Catholic patriarch, Abdusha IV, and it's he who travels to Rome in 1561. And because he offers this kind of connection with an Eastern church, his coming to Rome was sort of quite the cause celebre at the time. He writes a poem. Abdusha wrote a poem on his predecessor's life and death. Of course, they see Sulakar as a martyr. And it's interesting that he very much emphasises Sulakar's pilgrimage to Rome and the kind of glory of Rome as this centre of Christian authority and of ancient Christianity. Abdusha's church itself, of course, is incredibly ancient. It's easy to forget now, but what's now Iraq and Syria, these are ancient Christian heartlands going well back into the 3rd, 2nd century during the Roman era. And yet he's happy to emphasise the glory of Rome as the centre of Christendom. It's a question, it is significant for Rome because he's advertising his kind of cultural and religious acceptance of Rome as the centre of Christianity. Although he is an Eastern Catholic who comes from a quite different cultural tradition of Catholicism. And he also brought a knowledge of Syriac literature with him to Rome. It was sometime after his journey there that the first Chaldean missal was able to be published in Rome in 1592. One historian has emphasised Abdusha and his trip to Rome and his inclusion in this very papalist artwork as symbolising for Rome and also presumably for the Chaldean Catholics that he led this potential union between East and West, and that what they see as the sort of tragedy of the schism can be overcome, and that even with all of these liturgical and tradition differences, the Pope can still make this claim to be the global leader of a global Christianity.
And there we shall leave it. Thank you.